Mental Health Monday
on Radio City Talk
with Mick Coyle.
Tackling the stigma.
Radio City Talk.
Okay, so it's Mental Health Monday. We're back on Radio City Talk. My name is Mick Coyle. Got a really great guest on the programme today, but don't forget previous editions of the programme you can check out via our podcast. Just type in Mental Health Monday to any of your podcast providers and you can get more than 100 episodes of the show. Got a really positive reaction to last week's show. We were talking about Addiction Awareness Week. We're going to spend some time now with a guest to the programme who you may be aware of from the work she does on TV, but a fascinating story to tell, and she's on her own mental health journey, as we all are. We welcome Sian Clifford to the programme. Sian, thank you for your time.
Hello, my absolute pleasure to be here.
And Sian, people will know you from the TV show Fleabag. Well, I'll indulge in that in a little bit of time, because people will think, oh, it's Claire from Fleabag, ask loads of questions about that. It's not what we're here to talk about, Sian, but we'll come on to that a little bit later on. You've got your own project, though, in regard to mental health and your own mental health journey. Can I just ask you, at what point in life, Sian, did you think mental health, right, this is an issue here, and an issue which actually as a human being I need to tackle and deal with?
Yeah, well, it's something that I think goes, there is a lot of conversation around it now, which I'm very, very grateful for, but what I didn't have growing up was that kind of openness about, or that there wasn't, that dialogue wasn't available to me. And it wasn't until I was about 28 that I sort of, and really it's only now that I realise that at the age of 28 I'd probably spent half of my life, so about 14 years, in and out of bouts of quite serious depression, but just hadn't had a language for it. I had done some talk therapy at that stage, but it wasn't until I went on a retreat actually, and it was just because I'd been working a lot, and honestly, it was my intuition that led me to go on that retreat. And for me, connecting to your intuitive power is my number one thing, because that's how you know you can find the resources and the tools that serve you the best, regardless of what's helped other people you may know. And it was my intuition that sort of led me to go on this retreat. And that's where I first discovered meditation and yoga and all sorts of weird and mystical things, which I have indulged in and continue to indulge in. And I really encourage other people to do the same, to sort of explore what's available, because it really is vast, and what works for you might not have even have been discovered yet. So I really encourage people to just sort of get stuck in and see what works. But since that moment, and I basically experienced a very significant breakup with my boyfriend at the time, that was a catalyst for me. And I always think there is usually a catalyst. It might be a grief of some kind, or a loss, or an accident, or anything. There's usually like a sort of an act of God that happens in someone's life that makes you confront things in a way that you might not have done before. And that was sort of the second like significant breakup I'd experienced, and there was no way I was going to allow myself to sort of endure what I had the first time. And so it was an intuitive response to that, to just take better care of myself. And it was only in beginning to explore those aspects of myself that I sort of realized how dark the space was that I'd been in since I was a teenager.
What were your aspirations or hopes when you signed up to go on that retreat? Was there something that you had in mind, or was it just a sense that, well, if I go and test this out, this might offer me a solution or an option?
No, honestly, it was just, I think I'd seen, there was a friend of mine, and I'd seen on Instagram or on Facebook or something, she would go on these retreats a lot, and I always sort of, I don't know, they always just looked amazing. So I was like, I'm going to do that. But it was funny. And there were sort of these, how do you describe it? I mean, there were a lot of synchronicities that sort of led to the moment of my decision. And it did feel like there was some kind of thread of magic in the air, that something was trying to support me, was greater than myself. I couldn't see. And I sort of met the right people at the right time. Because my friend who would go on these retreats, she'd go to very expensive sunny climes to go and do these retreats, and that was sort of beyond my means. at that moment in time. And someone I was working with recommended me something much cheaper in Ireland, which wasn't the sort of tropical paradise I had envisioned. But I looked into it and it was within my price bracket, and it fell on like the one weekend that I had 2 weeks off between jobs. And so it was only that window that I could go. So I wrote to them, I emailed them and said I'd like to join. And then they told me that they were fully booked. They couldn't take me. And I reported this back to my colleague at the theatre, and she said, oh, don't worry, trust in the universe. And I said, what does that mean? And she said, well, you've put it out there. If it's meant for you, it won't pass you by. And so I sort of forgot about that. And then the next day I got an email saying that a space had opened up and I could go. And that sort of moment of enlightenment, and it, you know, really did feel for me like some kind of divine intervention, because I was really exhausted. I didn't have the energy to look for somewhere else, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And anyway, and then I went, and I didn't have any expectations at all. I went with a very open heart and low expectations, and yeah, and it was extraordinary. The people that I met and connected with, I don't know, there were books there that I'd never seen or heard of before, and there were ideas being spoken about that I'd never seen or heard of or heard about before, and it piqued my interest. And I think I was always someone that would probably be interested in these things, but like I say, there was just no conversation about it when I was growing up. So I'm thrilled that there is now for people my age as well as young people.
It always strikes me, Sean, when you hear conversations with those who are experts in the mental health field, that there's a relative simplicity to what they're saying. At no point are you having to learn kind of like rocket science. And as you're hearing it, it all kind of, like a perfect teacher, it all seems to make sense as it sort of arrives, that point of contact. Was that something that you found, that things just seem to make sense?
Yes, absolutely. You've articulated that so much more beautifully than I just have in the last 7 minutes. But it's... yeah, it does. There's just things arrive that make sense, that speak to you, that you have an affinity with. And that's, again, why I encourage people to dive into all aspects of what's available right now. And there's so much available, because you don't know what will resonate with you. And, you know, I think meditation is an extraordinarily powerful tool, but it can actually be quite dangerous for people with PTSD, and that is not commonly known or talked about. You know, and that's something that's really spoken to me and has stayed with me. I mean, I have a daily meditation and yoga practice that just doesn't waver. But that's not to say that I found it easy initially, but I did connect to it. It was something I had to stick at.
Can I ask you about that? Because people might be looking for a balance in life in regard to some of the issues you've been talking about there. The coping strategies, if you like, be it a meditation, times that you set aside for yourself every single day, versus the other thing, which is all the other things that life's thrown itself or life is throwing at you, and things that you're thinking, well, I need to be able to manage those better or stop some of those things, put them to one side, be it stresses or work commitments or commitments you want to try and drop but you can't because you feel like it's going to have implications on your career, which you could meditate about all day long, but maybe, you know, those problems would then potentially continue as well. How do you strike that balance between the coping versus tackling the issues why you felt you needed to cope in the first place?
Well, I think what meditation gifts you, or conscious awareness, I would say, because I don't think meditation is the answer to everything or everyone, is it gives you space. It gives you the means to make decisions that are more aligned with you. It gives you clarity. It gives you a freedom of awareness that you might not have had before. So it gifts you tools that you didn't know you have. I can genuinely say that my relationship with time has completely changed since I started meditating. So I have even though I think there's a, I think it's a Buddhist saying, and I could be attributing this to the wrong person, but that if you don't have time to meditate for 5 minutes a day, then you need to be meditating for 2 hours. Because it really does, time gets stretchy when you start to meditate. When you provide yourself with that space, it really shifts your perspective on things. And so I don't set aside time to meditate. I let it find me in the cracks of my life. So whether it's stood on an escalator, whether it's waiting for a traffic light to change, whether it's sat on the tube, whether it's when I'm sat on set not doing anything, on the toilet. I mean, honestly, any little moments that I can grab to do what I call check-ins, they to me are more powerful than sitting down and meditating for an hour. Because they are, when it creeps in to all areas of your life and those tiny little moments, then you know that you're listening to yourself in a way that, like you say, if you sit down and you can meditate on these things, and I do meditate on my problems, I do give them time and weight and the things that they need. And that's another thing, I always say that meditation isn't about sitting still or clearing your mind. A massive misconception, I think, because a lot of people say, well, I've got a really, really busy mind, I could never switch it off. No, you're absolutely right, you can't switch it off. Or they're like, I can't sit still, I can't, you know. And yeah, I mean, we're never still, we're never truly silent. There's always, you know, your breath is always going to be making noises. There's all sorts of these things that surround the idea of meditation that I think prevent people from trying it. And actually, I actively encourage people to meditate on a problem. So if there is something, like, sit and listen to that busyness, listen to what it's saying to you, because if you give it the space and know and give it permission to sort of come forward and be heard, it will ease off. I mean, it genuinely does.
Somebody a few weeks ago, we were talking about the issue of mindful walking, and they'd said, I mindfully walked to the radio studios to be with you today. And I said, well, what did that feel like? And expecting someone to have almost floated the way from the train station up to the studio. But actually, no, it was just like, I just concentrated on my footsteps. I listened to the sounds of the traffic, and I lived in that moment for those moments that I was walking between the train station and the radio station. And I thought, actually, those sort of moments that you gift yourself to think, you know what, I'm not going to worry about what's coming up in the next hour, the next 2 hours, the next 4 hours for tea, getting the kids ready for school the next day, whatever it is. I'm just going to, in this moment, experience walking. And actually, that it's quite strange that we've almost got to train ourselves just to think about the thing that we're doing at that very moment, which in many ways is the most important thing because you're doing it now.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what you were asking me about. You're asking me about balance, about finding balance. And that's the thing, is we're so distracted all the time. You know, we're all multitaskers. Some people will say they're great multitaskers and some people will say they won't, but we're all doing it all the time. You know, you can be on your phone and walking, terrible idea, especially crossing the road. A friend of mine posted an Insta story a couple of days ago and he was driving, and I messaged him and I was like, don't you ever do that again. Like, that is insanity. And he responded and he was like, I'm so sorry. I don't know what I was thinking. And we're so sort of culturally, we are all multitaskers. And I don't know that any of us are very good at it, because if you're not paying attention to the moment at hand, then you're not really experiencing it. You're somewhere between the future and the past.
There's an expectation from almost society, that we feel it in ourselves, that we've all got to be multitasking now, that you've got to have three different minds going on three different things at any one time, plus dealing with social media, work emails arriving all the time, thinking about this, that, the other. Even if you're thinking about things you want to do positively in your life, be it saving the environment, which midnight it is that night, that there's always the things ticking over in your mind. And there's almost an expectation that you've got to be multitasking, that these are the balls you've been handed and these are the balls you've got to juggle on any given day.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important, for regardless of what's going on in the news cycle, regardless of what is going on in your personal life, regardless of all the emails that you have to respond to or what's on your to-do list, for me, it's so important that you just keep coming back, keep checking back in, keep just observing how you're feeling, because it's I'm so much for, if that's even English, prevention rather than cure. And I think so many of us allow ourselves to get to the brink and beyond it before we take action. And I think that's why it's so important to do those, the consistency of the regular check-in throughout your day, every day, is what's going to prevent that from happening. So if you observe in yourself, like for example with me, I know immediately when I've been spending too much time on social media, and I just take myself off. And I mean it's a big issue. I mean, someone was posting yesterday about there was an article yesterday about, you know, social media is the new smoking and we are all addicted. That's if you're on it, of course, and I am. But in terms of like finding a balance with all of those things, I always say one of my other kind of, so my side hustle, Still Space, examines all sorts of aspects of mental health, I guess, and heightening conscious awareness in all aspects of your life. But one of the big messages behind it was that, again, destroying the myth that busyness and burnout equate to success. And I think that's why we are all so not only busy, but also needing to perceive to be busy in order to prove something to one another that we're doing enough and that we are enough. And what I've come to discover from my own mental health practices is that, you know, you're enough as you are. And actually, even words like self-improvement or self-help can actually be destructive in a way, because they're about not being enough as you are right now. And I really believe we all are enough as we are right now. And that's something that's really helped me to sort of stop asking people what they're up to next, stop asking people what they do, ask them what they're passionate about. It's been a retraining for me, like, as you say, taking a mindful walk. I often go on what I call intuitive walks, where I don't decide where I'm going, I just leave the house. And I might put a time limit on it if I've got stuff to do, but the fact that I've shown up for myself in that way for, I don't know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and it can really be tiny, these tiny little moments, they add up. So I do also often just leave the house and say, right, you've got 10 minutes, see where you end up. And sometimes I'll end up staying out of the house for much longer than that. It's the same, that's what I do whenever I go running. I don't ever, I don't put goals on myself, because I've actually stopped using to-do lists as well, because they somehow made me feel guilty about not getting everything done. I only use to-do lists now as a reminder of stuff, just because I'm spinning a lot of plates, especially at the moment. But I never create to-do lists as a kind of, you need to. And also, I find that language is so, so powerful. So there are words that we can change. So rather than saying, you know, what do I have to do today, you say, what do I get to do today? Rather than saying, what do I need to do today, you say, what do I want to do today? And things like that. They're small, subtle shifts. These are the things that will lead to a much bigger change in your life, in my experience, anyway.
That's one of those, isn't it, where people say, what if it all goes wrong? And you say, or you think, yeah, but what if it all goes right? And then we don't treat ourselves like that, do we? We don't allow ourselves those moments of thinking, how do I look at this from a positive point of view? It seemed like it's almost built in.
The anticipation of fear or the thing that might happen is always so much worse than the thing. It's always worse than the thing, the anticipation of the thing. I've always been someone who more and more is trying to say yes to fear, or to feel the fear and do it anyway. I don't believe fearlessness exists. I think, and especially creativity and fear are bedfellows, unfortunately. And I believe everyone is creative, by the way, because I think thought is creative. So whether you're creating a spreadsheet or painting, a portrait, I think we're all creative, and it's that creativity that resides inside us which is what enables us to take a detour, to recognize that we are not in a space that we want to be in, and to make a change, or to work out how to resolve something or find a solution to something that seems impossible. Like, that's the creative in us, and feeding that aspect of us is so important to me.
We've got Siobhan Clifford with us on Radio City Talk. The website, the project she mentioned, still-space.com. The website's still kind of up and running. It's been built. It's going to expand the project over the coming weeks, months and years as well. People can find out more information online, still-space.com. People might click on that one, Siobhan, and they might go, oh, it's Claire from Fleabag. I wonder what this is about. And I think they might be surprised just how open and honest you are right from the very front in regard to your own mental health journey and some of the issues that you faced, talking about other things, including suicidal thoughts, you know, one of those supposedly, you know, great taboos, but you put it right out there front and center in a confident way, that you've not been in any way, shape or form embarrassed about those feelings, and you've kind of gone, look, this is part of the story, this is part of the journey.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing that holds us back as humans from communicating lovingly and from finding compassion with others is our own shame. And I've been told many times by members of my family that I'm the expressive one, but maybe I was born that way, maybe I was shaped that way, I don't know, but I cannot bear an elephant in the room. I've never been able to deal with it. And so I do tend to confront things, and I think it's so important that we dismantle taboos around anything, really. It's so unhelpful for us and our humanity. I do think the future belongs to the storytellers, which is not to say that everyone suddenly needs a platform to get up and share, but just we need to talk to each other about our experiences in order to know that we're not alone. The human experience is universal. That pain is relative. You know, I often will hear people do down their own pain because in comparison to another person's experience, it can't, you know, it's nowhere near as bad. But you haven't had that person's experience, you've had your experience. And I think it's important that we don't draw those comparisons. I always say the death of everything begins with comparison, because all you've got is your own experience. And yeah, I think we've got to be more honest and frank about these things, because I think they're completely normal. They're not great spaces to be in, but it is completely normal. And until we sort of accept that, then we can't manage it as a society. We can't support each other. You know, the same goes for, spoiler alert, if you haven't watched Fleabag Series 2, but miscarriage comes up. You know, miscarriage is something which is it's so common. And there are so many things, particularly about the female experience, I will say, that are not talked about or have an incredible amount of shame around them. And I do feel those conversations are starting to happen. And I'm so, so proud and grateful to be a part of a project that has brought a lot of those conversations into the mainstream. That's really exciting for me. But yeah, I think, you know, that we've got to start talking, we've got to start connecting, we've got to start holding each other up. Yeah, I think it will make the world a better place.
Can I ask you time frames on that one, in terms of having had suicidal thoughts versus the sort of thoughts and feelings you have towards expressing those thoughts now? Was that a journey in and of itself? I'm not sure what age it was that you were having those kind of thoughts. Was there a moment where you thought, oh, actually, that experience I had any number of years ago, I can talk about it now? Or did you have to learn to sort of process in your own mind what it is you had experienced, why you'd experienced it, and how you then thought about it in a different space and time?
So I first sort of had those thoughts when I was a teenager, off and on until, yeah, like I was when I was 28. So it was like half of my life. And I think up until that moment, I'd accepted it as the norm. I was like, this is just how I'm going to feel for the rest of my life. Which is how I often hear people talk about depression. And just to add what I was saying before about language and the power of language, I very, very consciously choose to say I experienced or experience. I'm not completely free of dark moments, of course. I experienced depression. I don't say I suffer from depression. That's a massive, massive shift you can make in your language. And it means that you are not a victim to this thing. It means it's something that's part of your experience, but it doesn't own you. And so I want to offer that out if that's helpful to anyone. It certainly helped me. But yeah, it wasn't till I sort of come through a kind of a healing period that I recognised where I'd been. So yes, there was definitely a period of processing. And it wasn't till I'd sort of experienced a significant period of time where I hadn't been in that space that I saw how dark it was. And deciding to talk about it, so I was, so I have a whole bunch of YouTube videos on my YouTube channel, which is just youtube.com/stillspace. And yeah, you'll find the video on there where I talk about depression, and there's I think there's like 35 videos or something like that on all sorts of topics. And I don't know, part of the reason I mentioned the competition is because that was a real test for me to put something of myself forward. I felt like that was my unique selling point. I didn't want to, I know that the other people that were involved in the competition, they were maybe picking subjects that were trendy or that were, I don't know, could be well marketed or whatever. But I was like, all I've got is my own experience. And I'm a storyteller, I'm an actor. I was like, that's my USP. And so, I don't know, again, it completely intuitively led those videos and the creation of those videos and that video in particular. So there was no agenda. I didn't think about it other than this is an important story that I want to share. I guess I knew through the power of storytelling that we can connect more deeply. And if one person watches that video and feels that they are seen and that they're not alone, then it's worth it. So there was, I think there probably was a moment of sort of like, do I, don't I, courage required before I recorded that video. But it was very intuitively led, and I didn't really think about it much in terms of what impact will this have or anything. I just was like, I want to share this bit of myself because maybe it will help someone else.
And people can see it at youtube.com/stillspace and the Still Space Project, which is up and running, still-space.com as well. Sean Clifford, our guest on Mental Health Monday this week. The actor who played Claire in Fleabag. Can you indulge me in a couple of Fleabag-related points?
Sure. What do you want to know?
I just wanted to say, I just thought the second series, you know, when you watch something, you go, well, don't make another series because it won't be as good as the first one. And then the first episode was literally better than the entire first series. It was like next level stuff, which was going to places nobody anticipated. And also, I don't know if you're aware that you got like the moment of the series in series two.
Are you going to talk about the airport?
No, I'm going to talk about the haircut.
Oh, the haircut!
The haircut moment is one of those moments. For people who don't know, there's this great moment where there's all these series of events which seems to get worse and worse and build up and build up and build up. And your character rings Fleabag, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and something clearly terrible has happened. And as viewers, you're thinking, oh my, what's happened now? There's the issue you mentioned with the miscarriage, there's the marriage, the son, the Swedish love interest, and it's all, and you think, what could it be now? Cut, and then it just cuts to the image of you. And it was just one of those kind of like brilliant emotional reactions you have to a TV show, because it was kind of like a sense of humor but also relief, and also a sense of what on earth is, like, what series of events have occurred that have led to this particular haircut, which follows onto this scene with the actual hairdresser itself, which in itself is like, it's like perfect TV comedy. Both that and the fox, that was the other bit, the fox. I enjoyed the fox.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the fox. So there have been, I mean, we just released in America, and I'm sort of going to dare to say the response there has been even bigger than here to the second series. And but they, in the last week alone, I mean, there are thousands of articles being written about the show at the moment. It's absolutely insane, the response, and we're so sort of thrilled and overwhelmed. But two brilliant pieces, so seek them out. They're on my Twitter. You can find them on my Twitter. Who am I? I'm Sean's Universe on Twitter. There's one that's this whole theory about the fox and what the fox symbolises. And it is, I mean, it made me cry. It's so beautiful. It's such a beautiful article. And then there's another one that's about hair. Hair is everything. And I love that you brought that up, because I mean, the article actually talks about it, about Fleabag being obsessed with hair, but it's Claire is obsessed with her hair, you know, and she does strange things with her hair whenever she's in a moment of crisis. And it really, what's brilliant, and it says this in the article, is, you know, the hairdresser says to them, if you want to change your life, you know, you won't find it here. But actually, it does change Claire's life. And that it's such a huge turning point for her, that moment where she takes a risk, it goes cataclysmically wrong. And that is, I mean, I always say when people are like, you know, why does she stay with Martin? And I always say, because failure to Claire is death. And she can't admit that her marriage has failed, and she sure as hell can't admit that she's made a bad choice for her new haircut. But she does, and it really propels her into the final episode and the choice that she makes in that one, which I won't spoil for listeners.
Why did she? No, I'm not going to. No spoilers there. You're now involved in, we'll mention the Twitter, at Shan's Universe, the YouTube channel for Still Space, and the website as well, still-space.com. Shan, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the programme. Really appreciate you joining us for Mental Health Monday, and best of luck with the project, and we look forward to hearing more about the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much. I'm on Instagram as well, guys. I love a pretty picture, but I'm Shan Still Space on there. And you can get... if people are interested, there's a free meditation on my site, which I need to review and re-record probably. Forgive me, I did it in a cupboard in my old flat. But that's available, and it talks more in depth about breath work and the power of meditation and dismantling those myths around it. So check that out. And the website is expanding. It's sort of been sitting dormant for ages, but I promise I'm getting on it, and there'll be more fun resources available.
Brilliant. Thank you for your time, Shan. Really appreciate you joining us on the programme.
Thank you.
Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk with Mick Coyle.
Radio City Talk.